Welcome to the Mind Money Spectrum podcast, where your hosts, Aaron Ogti and Trishul Patel, go beyond traditional finance questions to help you explore how to use your money to achieve the freedom you want in life.
In this episode, Trishul and Aaron discuss planning that parents and students go through before applying for college. Aaron shares his experience as a high school student and how he funded all 4 years with scholarships. Trishul explains how he started saving 2 years before his daughter was born. They discuss grants, loans, and the expected family contribution. There are so many resources available to help fund higher education that you need to start researching as early as you can. And now, on to our conversation.
Hi, my name is Aaron Ogti. I'm a financial advisor in the Bay Area, and I'm here with Trishul Patel, a wealth manager on the East Coast.
Hey, Aaron, great to be here today, and thanks everybody for listening.
Great to be here as well. So a few weeks ago, we had Molly Lauder on to talk about student loans and kind of some of the different programs that are available to those individuals who have already gone to college, already have the student loans in place. And one of the reasons I really wanted to bring Molly on is I was in a position where I actually funded college via scholarships. And so I didn't have any student loans when I graduated and just didn't have that personal experience that Molly did. And that's why I like kind of deferring to experts when I acknowledge limitations of my own experience and knowledge. But today, Trish and I want to talk a little bit about my experience before going to college. Kind of like that was his question to me. Okay, that's awesome. You funded 4 years at of a university via scholarships. We should talk about that. And so I'll kind of talk about my experience in high school, how that happened, how it could apply to some students or suggestions for parents of students that are looking at the college application process and funding college, but also acknowledging our own limitations. And so kind of trying to be honest and transparent about what we know, but also the areas that we just don't have the experience with. So before I get into my story, Trishul, any kind of big picture items related to college or college funding that you think are relevant that we will make sure we talk about today?
Well, just at a high level, in terms of the workflow that somebody goes through, or you know, the steps that somebody goes through when they think about college funding, it'd be interesting to note that there's probably different strategies that you want to think about in this whole process, and that can start as early as, you know, from the moment you start thinking of having kids to coming up with funding strategies as those kids are, you know, born and start maturing. And then there might be a different set of strategies to think about, you know, once the kids are approaching college, you know, like they're getting ready to apply. And then, of course, there's different strategies once you're actually in college. And then, Aaron, like you had mentioned, there's other strategies that you have for paying off the loans that we discussed with Molly. So I think it's the earlier part of that workflow that we're probably going to be digging into today.
Okay, so I think I want to start probably around ninth grade. I'll explain why in just a minute. But I want you to mention, how early did you start planning for college for your children?
We just have one daughter right now, and it's something that came up in one of these earlier episodes in the podcast. But yeah, we ended up funding a 529 plan 2 years before my daughter was born, meaning we kind of knew we wanted to have kids, and we knew that this was a good opportunity to get tax-deferred growth. So why not start sooner rather than later? And that's something that is possible with this type of education account.
So you started funding a 529 plan for a child that had not been born yet. And I think that's probably the most extreme example I've seen or experienced or heard of. So kind of good job for you. Good job by you, Trishel. You made yourself the beneficiary of the 529 plan. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, I can also use it if the opportunity comes up. And what we also realized is that in my family, my parents ended up funding my education, and, you know, my grandparents had funded my parents' education, and we kind of knew that this was in the mail. So we had this pay it forward kind of mentality when we were thinking about education funding in general. So that's why we thought, you know, why not start sooner rather than later if it's part of the master plan.
Okay. And I think that's probably the good default advice, that just the earlier you start saving, the better. And 529 plans are probably the best college savings vehicle. There are pros and cons to that. But I think today we're more thinking about for those kind of students who are closer to applying for college. So it's like starting about ninth grade and their parents. So kind of what are some of the options that you have? After college, so I went to UCLA. I've talked about that a few times, and I'm a very proud Bruin. And one of the things I did after college was volunteer at college fairs. So UCLA and UC Berkeley or Cal will have alumni volunteer to go to high school college fairs to speak to high school students about their experience at UCLA. So as part of this, I actually got some training from the admissions office and got some of the basic facts and information that you need to know. It doesn't have to be too detailed. I'm not an employee of the college admissions office, but at least I understand some of the high-level concepts. And the reason I say I bring that up as kind of background information is that's why I start at ninth grade. So being in California, a lot of the college advice I have to parents and high school students is really focused around the University of California system, the UC system, and the California State University system, the CSU system. And one of the big things is just kind of pointing out that the application process, the admission process, they only look at grades for your 10th and 11th year. So your sophomore and junior years, they don't look at freshman year, they don't look at senior year grades. So even if you were kind of messing up and not getting your ideal grades in ninth grade, that wasn't an impact on your college application. But starting in ninth grade, if you can start thinking about college, that's about when you should be taking the PSAT. I think it's just the pre-SAT. That's usually designed for either 8th or 9th graders, sometimes 10th graders, depending on the level of math. But there are scholarship programs available depending on scores and results of the PSAT. There are also, it's kind of just building up practice for taking the SAT, because that was a big theme for me going through high school. I actually got straight A's in high school, and I was the valedictorian. So a lot of my scholarships were more merit-based. So I started with the PSAT, and I actually took the SAT, I think, five times my sophomore, junior, and senior years, mostly my junior year. But I got pretty good at taking the SAT, and I had a lot of experience. So there were no test-taking anxiety because I had done enough times. I knew all the logistics. I knew exactly where the testing location was. I knew what the process was. So I showed up and had my calculator and my pencils ready and waited for the proctor to give the instructions because I'd already heard them several times. So I already knew what that process was. But I bring that up because there's both benefits of going through my kind of experience, but also I want listeners to understand where my experience may not apply. So I got straight A's in high school. I took the SAT and the PSAT many times. But the biggest difference for me was how many scholarships I applied to. My junior and senior year, and the first half of my senior year, I think I applied for about 50 scholarships, if not more. I think I was averaging about one scholarship application per week. And in the end, by the time I was graduating high school and getting ready to go to college, it was two main big scholarships I received. One was the UC Regents Scholarship. This was given to the top 300 applicants to UCLA, and they used it to convince a student like me, who also got into UC Berkeley, and other top students who might apply to the UC schools, but may also apply to some of the top private schools, such as Stanford or the Ivy Leagues. They use that to convince those top students to go to UCLA. And that actually worked for me. So that's covered most of my tuition, books, and fees. I also received another private scholarship for, I think it's $3,000 a year. That was my other biggest scholarship. That took care of a lot of the room and board components. But I also had at least a dozen other scholarships that were one-time $500 or $1,000 scholarships that kind of added up, kind of really build up enough where I could use that to pay for college. And this is probably the one thing that is replicable, where it, even though it helped my applications for these scholarships to have straight A's and good test scores, it was just the fact that I applied to so many. I applied to the local VFWs, the Veterans of Foreign Wars. Then they had a $500 scholarship. I think I won a small Marine Corps scholarship. There was an American Legion scholarship. I think sometimes there's a Daughters of the American Revolution scholarship. There's a lot of these organizations with local chapters that are looking to give away, again, $500 to a local high school student. And sometimes they only get one or two applicants. Now, I don't know if this has changed much, or if the kind of publicity of these types of scholarships has increased or maybe easier to find. But I would walk into my high school counselor's office, and they had a – this was would have been 1999, 2000. So there was a website that you'd use to search for scholarships, but a lot of them were just still paper applications. Like, I had to actually make a photocopy of the application, take it home with me, and write the essay. But it was that idea of just keep applying for all of these scholarships. And even though they're small, they're not going to fully fund 4 years at a UC school. They did add up and they did make a difference. So it's the lesson kind of, there's money out there for scholarships, especially merit-based, and just having that mentality of applying for those scholarships and asking for it really made the difference for me. A few other notes and context. My dad was in the Navy. He was when he got out, he was a disabled veteran. He got out right around the time I graduated high school. And because he's a disabled veteran, there is a program that's part of the GI Bill where his dependents can get free tuition at certain in-state public schools. Now, he wasn't disabled. He wasn't a labeled disabled veteran while I was in college, but he was when my younger brother and younger sister were going to college. So through that program, they were actually able to have books and tuition available for free. They had to pay for room and board. I know my brother got one scholarship, and my sister ended up going to a different community college first. But it was just that idea that there's so many different things out there that you really have to start looking for them. But start looking and being ready about ninth grade. That this idea of don't wait until you're writing your essay for your application fall of your senior year of high school. So I think it pulled up the dates of the UC application deadline. So you can start getting your application August 1st of 2021 to apply. This is being for seniors in high school. They'd be applying to be, they're graduating spring of 2022, and they want to go to start school fall of 2022. But then that's when they can get the application and start working on it, but they can't actually submit it until November. November 1st through 30th is the application filing period for all admissions for fall of 2022. And so that's why I kind of don't wait until then to start thinking about how you're going to pay for it. Start all the process sooner. Start taking the PSAT or SAT. I know actually the UC system is no longer including test scores in their admissions, but it may still look good on scholarship applications to take the SAT. But it does take practice, does take kind of time to get used to it and help kind of be aware. If you can kind of figure things out by ninth grade, then you can focus on which classes you take your sophomore and junior years to really make your overall resume look better to both college admissions and scholarship applications. So, Trishul, do you have any questions for me that have kind of helped fill in the gaps of things that I might have forgotten to mention?
Well, first of all, well done, Aaron. It seems like you were very proactive and beyond the level of proactiveness that I don't know if I could have considered for myself attainable at that age. I think a large part of the whole college question didn't really start to surface in my mind until I got far closer towards that application process. And I think you're right, having a better understanding sooner rather than later would probably be sensible, especially since it's a bit complicated, you know, having all of these various pieces to tie together to come up with a workable solution for perhaps the biggest investment you would have to make up until that point. And frankly, the biggest investment you might be making, you know, with your time and money in your life, I would say. So as you were going through that process, was it your guidance counselor that provided you with these initial steps, or how'd you kind of figure it out from the get-go?
I think actually because my dad was in the Navy, my mom was a teacher, we were a comfortable middle-class family, but they were very honest and upfront with me that they were not going to be able to afford to pay for college. So like I knew that early, and I also knew I was a good student, and I think I'd gotten straight A's in 8th and 9th grade. So I knew I could go down this path, but they were very encouraging of like starting early, knowing that they weren't going to pay for college. So like I knew that. And so it was even one of those things like even if I got into Stanford, because that was the one I had in mind in high school was the kind of elite private school on the West Coast. Even if I got in, I didn't know how I was going to apply for it. Like I knew loans were a thing, but I just had this, I did have that concept of, I don't know if I want that much in loans. And kind of that self-awareness of, okay, I know I can get into some of these schools. I know I'm good enough there, but how am I going to pay for them? That's when I kind of started off that process of taking the SAT, trying to work on my SAT scores and focusing on starting those scholarships, like understanding how do you get scholarships? Like that was kind of one of the things I did look into relatively. The high school counselor didn't really push me as more as they kind of kept a big, like it was like a plastic bin that was like a little file folders, and they would just keep scholarships in there, the scholarship applications forms in there. They all the students could come in, so I would kind of keep going in and asking them, but I didn't feel that they kind of pushed me to apply for those. And I've talked to a couple other friends from college who did go to private high schools, and depending on the high school, they consistently got kind of more help with that college application process. There was kind of more communication with counselors. That was definitely a bigger emphasis. One I know didn't feel like the academic experience was that different. One of my roommates in college, he went to a private high school where there the academic experience was different. So the high school I went to in Imperial Beach, it's a suburb of San Diego. It's actually all the way down on the border and on the ocean. So the nickname is the most southwesterly city in the continental United States. But the economics and demographics of the area meant that I didn't have to actually pay for any AP tests. So I took as many as I could. I think I took 9. I ended up passing 8 as part of my high school experience. But one of my roommates in college went to private school. You had to test in for the high school to allow you to take the AP test. You had to kind of show you could qualify, because this school maintained, I think, an average AP score of 4.5. So like all their students of all the tests they took, most students would either get a 4 or 5, pretty much. So all the students that were taking the test were passing. And that's what the school used to kind of show the academic rigor of that school, and it helped his application process. Whereas I took 9. I took one that I didn't even have an AP class in. I think I took the AP physics test and had never learned electricity or magnetism. So I was really shocked when they came up on the test. Did not pass that one. But I think I got mostly 3s and a couple 4s on my math AP tests. But it's just that was kind of the difference I noticed after the fact of the private high schools. There's more push on that college counselor and that process, whereas I had to learn a lot of it on my own. And so from that point forward, I've just really been pushing awareness. That's why, like, seriously, start in, again, like 9th grade, just to learn all of the things around applying for college. Not even just building up grades and what goes into your college application, but everything else that's involved as well.
Yeah, it really seems like this is maybe the first time a student has to really reach beyond the scope of, you know, their education and come up with a real formalized plan that can be a little complicated to figure out. And it seems like it does take some personal drive if there isn't that push, you know, either from parents or from the school, which in many cases there may not be. So it seems like having a good understanding of what you might be up against is kind of important here.
Yeah, that's probably a good way to phrase it. Where is definitely just not you have your classes assigned for you. You might even have electives, and so you kind of you have a little bit of choice in the classes you take. But it definitely was that first kind of extra learning around it. It's like, how do your choice of classes impact your college application? So, for example, I know with the UC system, they have a really good registrar of all the classes available to each student at their particular school. And as long as you're taking the most challenging course available to you, they give you credit for that. So if you happen to go to a school that offers an honors but not an AP, they won't penalize you for that. They recognize that you are taking the challenging course and excelling. But if you happen to go to a school that does offer an AP course and you're taking the honors, that they will kind of penalize you for not challenging yourself to take the most academically rigorous course. So just kind of being aware of that kind of process, where it's, you do have to go beyond, sign up for classes, make sure you do your homework and get good test scores to try and get good grades. You really need to understand all the other parts that go into it.
Like, imagine how hard it is to get on top of, you know, like your financial life when you're an adult and, you know, you first graduate and you have like a paycheck and you have to figure out all the nuances there. I feel like figuring out the college application process is on the same order of complexity, you know, all the little things that go into it. Yet this is what we have to do even before we, you know, get out into the real world. It's like maybe the first adulting experience for, I guess, a teenager.
That's actually a great, great analogy. I'd probably even extend it. Yeah, if you got your first job, it's like, do you enroll in life insurance? What about disability insurance? Okay, do you participate in 401k? What fund choices do you have for your 401k? How does health insurance work at your new employer? Now imagine you've either just graduated high school, just graduated college, and this is the first time you've ever considered this. That gets really complex really fast. And I'd say, yeah, this probably is on that same scale. It's not just doing your job, or in this case, being a student is doing the classwork. It's all the extra stuff that's part of being an adult and being a human in just our society that we've added on that everyone has to learn through firsthand experience. So yeah, this is probably on that scale of complexity. And I know because it's difficult and because it's complex, there are services, consultants that have arisen to try and help out, but those, they charge money. And so there's kind of different demographic issues there. But yeah, it can be complex and it's a big learning curve. And we haven't even talked about those who aren't going to fund their way with scholarships. So kind of after saving a 529 plan from the time your child is born, then pushing them to apply for scholarships and trying to get that as much as possible, what are some other things that you're aware of to kind of help college funding kind of beyond just the getting into the school?
Right. So the three big things to think about at that point are there any grants that you may be able to fit into, or are there any loans? That's the next big one. Student loans are a big enterprise, and there's many options and frankly a lot of complexity to dig into there. And then the third thing to kind of think about is there are frankly also some tax credits that might help here. So we would probably want to think about those as well. And these can all kind of fill in little gaps or big gaps for coming up with a funding strategy that can get you, you know, all the way from a freshman to graduating.
Would these be tax credits for parents whose children are going to college?
Well, it depends, you know, who's the dependent, if the kid is on their own or not. And that's, I believe that's based on year, how old they are. And there's a cutoff where that kind of changes. But for example, the American Opportunity Credit is the main one that you would probably lean on in your undergrad years. It's designed for only the first 4 years of college. And it looks at the marginal adjusted growth, sorry, the MAGI of the parents. So
that modified adjusted gross income.
Yeah, modified adjusted gross income of the parents. And there's a phase out there, but if you're under the cutoffs, well, in that case, you could get 2,000 plus 25% of the next 2,000. So a total of 2,500 in credits. Now, these aren't deductions. That means actual dollar for dollar credit, which could go some ways. But you can only use that for the first 4 years of college. And the other thing to think about is you can't offset the credits if you have other types of deductions or you're using other types of tax advantage accounts to pay for college. So, for example, if you have a scholarship covering the full tuition, well, then you can't offset the credits for that same tuition that's being offset by the scholarship. So that's something to think about when you're trying to apply these. The second credit that comes up is something known as a lifetime learning credit. In this case, it's $2,000 max, and there's also phase outs and things to think about there. But the good thing here is it can be used for undergrad, grad school, continuing education, just kind of, it's a lot more broader in scope than the American Opportunity Credit. However, again, here, again, you can't stack the same credit for the same education expense. So you got to think about how these align with the actual tuition that you're trying to offset.
Okay, so this is saying like, you can't apply the same t the t those 2 credits to the same tuition amount.
Yeah,
Am I
that's
understanding that
right.
correctly?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. What were some of the grants you mentioned? Or are there other credits available?
Well, those are pretty much the main credits. And in terms of the other types of funding, well, this is the point where you would be taking distributions from your 529, for example. In that case, the whole benefit of the 529 is those distributions are tax-free. So you've already put in after-tax money, they've grown tax-deferred, and then all of that growth, instead of having to pay capital gains on those gains, you don't have to do that if you use those funds for qualified education expenses. Now, in terms of the grants, well, there's a few options here, and this is going to be depending on income. So again, we're going to probably segregate these into: is the family income, let's say, less than 60,000, or is it more? If you're less than 60,000, then we're in the bucket of there could be some loans and grants that are more suitable for these situations. And for the grants, these are the Pell Grants. And for the loans, these are the two big ones are the Supplemental Education Opportunity. Oh, sorry, that's a grant as well, the Supplemental Education Opportunity Grant. And the loans themselves are the subsidized Stafford student loans. So you may have heard of these as well. These loans and grants, again, are available towards households that are below certain thresholds, probably less than 60,000. Now, there's still opportunity to get loans, not necessarily grants, but loans if the household income is higher than that cutoff. In this case, these would be parent loans. So the loans are to the parent. And there are undergraduate students loans that are also available. So some of these loans, again, are more for, they're less in terms of need-based, but they're more for just having an opportunity to get loans that are, you can call them subsidized because they do have certain benefits that the government provides. And then, of course, there's private loans if you go outside of the framework of the federal government, and you could probably search for those types of loans through some sort of online marketplace to provide opportunity there to fill in any gaps that are remaining.
Okay, so I know when I was applying, this has been 20 plus years ago. I know that the FAFSA was a big important part, and I know kind of my parents as a 2-income household, they were above a lot of the thresholds, so the kind of expected family contribution was high enough that I didn't qualify for any need-based financial aid. So that's a big reason why kind of everything I applied for was merit-based. Do you know how much of these different loans and grants are kind of need-based versus merit-based? And kind of do we still use the FAFSA? I think that you mentioned that there's the expected family contribution, the EFC's going away.
Yeah, so let's dig into that. The FAFSA is basically the application itself that collects the data to apply for a lot of these different programs, the ones that I mentioned that are either based upon need or not based upon need. But in either case, the government wants to A, figure out, what is the need. So a big part of that equation is something known as the expected family contribution. And what that essentially means is there's a certain amount of need, let's say it's 15,000, and the government determines that the family is expected to contribute 5,000. Well, then that remaining 10,000 would be opened up towards these various programs that the government has, either through grants or loans. Now, the expected family contribution has two components. It's a component that comes from the actual applicant and a component that comes from the family that supports the applicant. And what it looks at is the income and the assets of both of those groups. So what the government tries to figure out is, okay, based upon you know, the amount of income that the child is earning or the student is earning and how much assets a student has, the government is going to weight that by a certain percentage and come up with, okay, this kid has X amount of assets, so a good chunk of that should go towards education. And then the government is also going to look at the parents' income and the parents' assets, and it's going to say, okay, we want some of that to also go towards education. And as it turns out, the percentage of the assets and income from the child is higher on a dollar-for-dollar basis, according to this calculation, than the contribution from the parents. So that's one thing to think about. If a child has a large or a significant amount of assets and income in their name, well, that's going to reduce their expected family, or sorry, increase their expected family contribution amount more than if that same income or assets were under the parent's name. So something to also think about. The other thing to think about with expected family contribution is that these numbers are based upon certain types of income and certain types of assets. For example, the government will not include retirement accounts when it comes up with these numbers. So things like that, depending on how assets of the household are organized, can help soften the blow of the expected family contribution amount, especially if a family has a large amount in retirement accounts. Well, then their expected family contribution would be lower than another family with the same amount of net worth, but with a low amount in retirement accounts.
Okay, so assets in the child's name, income in the child's name, assets in the parent's name, income in the parent's name, but in general, excluding retirement accounts.
Yeah, that's right. And it's an interesting funding strategy. For example, if a family has like a Roth IRA and you're allowed to, you know, take out the actual contribution, that might be one way to come up with some sort of funding strategy. It's not necessarily recommended, but, you know, something like that might be a source to tap into. However, you know, at a high level, I did mention earlier, you know, before we started this conversation, Aaron, that the FAFSA form is kind of getting a facelift, and the expected family contribution is also getting a revision. So earlier this year, an act was actually passed called the FAFSA Simplification Act. And the goal there was to try to make this process a lot more straightforward. It's a pretty complicated and cumbersome process, so maybe these tweaks will kind of help make things a little better. Now, these changes are going in effect for the 2023-24 academic year. So that's something to keep in mind. We're still about 2 years out, but what that means is when you start applying, you know, next year for the following year, that this is going to be important to understand. And one thing to realize with the expected family contribution is it's going to be changed to something called the student aid index. We'll dig into probably the specifics in a later conversation because it's not applicable for today or even what's going on in this year. So it's something we might have to think about for the future, but just know that changes are on the way.
Okay. So this is one of those things, like, I did it so like long enough ago and my kids are still far enough away that I don't feel that my knowledge is like really up to date, I guess I'd say. I'm aware of kind of the big enough pictures, but also I'm saving into the 529 plan for all three of my kids. And that's a big portion of what I'm doing right now, but I'm not worried about their high school grades I'm not even close to that yet. But are there any other things that you can think of that I should be aware that probably has changed since I applied to college?
Well, I think I'm probably in a similar boat. I'm a good two decades and change away from that type of situation for myself. And I think at the same time, you know, my child's four, so we got a good time before we have to even start thinking of these types of things. But, you know, in the situation that we're at right now, the 529 is a great vehicle. And I think just by you doing that, it's well ahead of what might make sense for somebody in our situation. Now, there are a few other funding options for the funding years besides the 529 that you may want to think about, maybe, maybe not. Frankly, I think the 529 has probably the most amount of flexibility and benefits among these other choices, which is why it's a pretty common choice. But just so that we kind of put notable mentions out there, it is possible, for example, to invest in EE education bonds, and these are bonds that are provided by the federal government. And the notion there is that if the bonds are used for qualified education expenses, well, then the income on those bonds would be deferred, and then you wouldn't have to pay income tax on that. So that's one benefit. But, you know, at the end of the day, you are talking bonds. And if you have a longer time horizon, I would probably think the more clear winner is investing in equities in a 529 rather than bonds. It's also important to understand there's something known as the Coverdell Education Savings Plan. But the tricky part there is this is like the older version of the 529. But the caps are kind of low, so that's why it's probably not so common. It's only $2,000 a year in terms of a contribution total. And that $2,000 is limited by on a per-child basis, meaning grandpa can't add another $2,000, you know, in the same year that mommy added their $2,000. So it's pretty hard to get a full funding strategy with something like that. Whereas with the 529, a good strategy there is you can kind of super fund it. You can put your $15,000 in for your annual gift tax exemption amount. But the government also says you can do 5 years all at once up front. So you can do 15 times five, $70,000 all at once from one parent. And you could double that to $150,000 if you have a partner for the child. So in 1 year, you could kind of super fund $150,000. And, you know, with 20 years or 18 years before a child goes off to school, that might be enough.
Yeah, I think one kind of quick caveat is that does use up your annual gift tax exemption for those 5 years. You can't pre-fund the 529 plan and then next year give a gift of $15,000, whether it's going to their name or to a trust, something like that. This does use up that exemption for those 5 years.
Right. And, you know, if a child is a dependent and they're young, then that might not be so much of an issue because you're allowed to pay for things for your kids to eat and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a more complex, very advanced estate planning strategy for households that are concerned about estate taxes and reducing estates and net worths over time.
Right.
I think the other thing I've seen is there's prepaid tuition plans where it used to be kind of you've picked a school or you picked maybe a state school system and you kind of paid for tuition now. And if they got into those schools, then it's already paid for. Realistically, kind of the only benefit you're getting is the money keeps pace with inflation of college education, where if college costs are increasing at 5%, kind of any prepaid tuition would be locking in that inflation. But realistically, they're not that flexible. There's a limit to the schools that you can apply to. They're trying to create bigger networks of schools participating. But I agree with you that using a 529 plan investing in equities would likely outpace any college inflation anyways. So it's these things exist. But again, I also don't recommend them for anyone.
Yeah, and you know, probably the last notable mention is it is possible to use UTMAs or UGMAs to have a separate account for the child's education. The one concern there is it would be subject to kiddie tax. However, there may be some small benefits because then you have a separate income stream that could come to the kid, and there is a little bit of a deduction that the kid gets before the kiddie tax kicks in. So I can't say it would make too much sense with college costs these days, because you probably won't be able to fund too much by taking that small deduction you get for before the kiddie tax kicks in. So yeah, at this point, I think even though these are all options, the 529 seems to make a lot of sense.
Yeah, the UTMA and UGMA is for college funding. Realistically, I don't see them being used for college. Kind of, this is money that will be in the child's name. So as soon as they're an adult, now, depending on the state you're in and kind of how it's set up, you could be given access at 18 or age 21 or even age 25. But basically, once they reach that adulthood, they're considered an adult and that money is all theirs. There's no longer any custodial arrangement or any influence from parents. And so this could be money that you're hoping to be a down payment on a house to kind of help them get started earlier. But it's kind of hard to know, well, is my five-year-old going to be financially responsible with excess money that would be used to either be going for college or going to a down payment on a house? And realistically, parents might use just a regular taxable investment account, a regular brokerage account, where now anything that's not in a 529 plan, this is because they're planning on paying for college and they're trying to save up in advance for it. Anything that they don't need to pay for college isn't necessarily, they're not necessarily planning on giving to the child in their early 20s. They'll probably use it for their own lifestyle or their own financial independence. And now it's the 529 plan is college specific. Again, it's still ideal. Anything outside it, probably just keep it in the parent's name, where the parents need to help pay for college, there's no restrictions on that account. If say the child does get scholarships or they go to a less expensive school or they choose not to go to college at all, then the parents can use it for their own well-being. So that's why I tend to see if it's college funding is kind of the goal of the money, we're likely not using an UTMA or UGMA. We'll use a 529 plan or a taxable investment account in the parent's name. And if it is money going to an UTMA or UGMA, it's usually money that's designed to maybe be for college, but more likely to help them out in their early 20s. Usually something like a down payment on a house that they may not be able to save up by themselves. So I think that the overall theme is there's just so much out there that you just need to start earlier to learn about it. Because I know even for myself, I literally did not know about the disabled veteran program until my younger brother was applying for it and using that to help pay for college. Even though I think it might have been able to apply my junior or senior year of college. It's one of those things I had saved up enough in scholarships and managed my expenses, so I had the money to pay. So I wasn't looking for other funding sources, but I think if I had done that, I still could have kept the scholarship money and either saved and invested it, or more likely because I was a college student, probably spent it on something, but it could have reduced my college expenses my senior year. Probably could have saved me somewhere between $5,000 and $15,000. So it's just, there's so many things out there that just kind of have to keep looking for them.
Yeah, it seems like a college funding plan is similar to like our energy plan in the U.S. It's not going to be solved by one. It's not likely to be solved by, you know, just one end all solution. It's going to be like a combination of, you know, solar, electric, hydro, and so on. So,
yeah,
with college funding, you got to think about all these buckets: pre-funding, saving up beforehand, and investing sensibly across those programs we mentioned. There's probably allocation in the pie to scholarships and other types of grants. And then there's loans to kind of make up the difference with private and public sector options available as well.
One last note I was just thinking of that could help me, but I don't know if it'll help you. When they do things like the expected family contribution under the current FAFSA, so we'll have to see how the student aid index changes, that expected family contribution is kind of per family. So if you have two kids going to college at the same time, that expected family contribution is almost cut in half. It's kind of, here's the family contribution for two students. And so each of those individual students can get more student aid or financial aid, depending on loans or grants. But if you want to plan for college like that, having multiple kids closer in age can help get a little bit more student aid.
Ah, that's an interesting one. So yeah, one kind of tidbit I've heard is, you know, let's say a grandparent is planning on helping out the kid. It's better actually that grandparent helps out for senior year rather than for, you know, freshman year, for example, because if the grandparent helps out for freshman year, then for like, you know, the sophomore junior year application, the government is going to say, hey, wait, you got income coming in from somewhere. And they're going to use that to reduce or increase your expected family contribution for, you know, those later years. However, if you wait till like senior year, well, then there's no more applying, you know, you're kind of through the hoops.
Yeah. Yeah, there's definitely opportunity for creative planning around this, from approximately freshman year of high school to graduating college. This is a good eight year window of complex planning.
Yeah, and you know, it's a big thing. It's a big investment, and a lot goes into it. And the funding side is definitely an important component.
Well, thank you for sharing all the research that you did. I really appreciate it, Trishul.
Well, thanks, Aaron, for being such a good student. That's really awesome that you were able to share that with us. I'm glad you had the opportunity to give us some insight on how all this works. And from the front lines, I think it's good to know that there are all these options out there.
Yeah, this is a good conversation. I like it. Thank you.
Great. And thanks, everybody, for listening. If you're enjoying these conversations, do spread the word. Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.
We appreciate you joining us today for this episode of the Mind Money Spectrum podcast. Be sure to visit mindmoneyspectrum.com to access the entire library of episodes. Remember, it's not black and white, but the wide spectrum of gray area where you get to pursue the freedoms you want in life. Opinions voiced in this material are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. All performance referenced is historical and is no guarantee of future results. All indices are unmanaged and may not be invested in directly. Have a nice day.